It wasn't Halloween, but it certainly felt like it. The place was eerie, gloomy, dank, and dark. It didn't help that the day itself was overcast. And except for the person who led us through the gates, there was no one around as Sue and I visited this mausoleum-like structure. We went from building to building, mostly in silence. Maybe it was the ghostly surroundings. Maybe the ghosts themselves. Who knows? But there was no question that lingering in that place were stories of horror. I don't think either Sue or I had a sense of how late it was when we started hearing doors closing. An even greater darkness was closing in on us. In a moment of panic, we had thoughts that the gatekeeper would close us in for the night, and we would be forced to stay, just like its former inhabitants. We ran for the door, relieved that it was still open. While there was a sense of relief as we went through the gate, it felt like there was a heavy darkness that still surrounded us. For the place we had just visited was hell. It was better known as Theresienstadt, one of the infamous Nazi concentration camps in what is now the Czech Republic, just north of Prague. I have met Holocaust survivors, and I had so many questions I wanted to ask them, but dare not do so. I had the same questions at Theresienstadt, as I saw shoes or hair or pictures. What was your story? What and how did you survive, or did you? What is your spirit like? What is your faith like? Did you remain religious? Did your understanding of God change? And so many more. And I have read a number of books on the Holocaust, but I still want to know what God, if any, you believe in when you have gone through hell. The larger question for me, though, is what is it that makes us religious? During that same trip to Europe, Sue and I also had the good fortune of visiting one of the prehistoric caves, Font de Gaume, in southwest France. I'm sure I mispronounced that. The over 200 polychrome paintings of bison, horses, reindeer, and mammoth in the cave are over 18,000 years old. And to enter that womb, to enter that cave itself, there was a sense of oneness with our prehistoric ancestors. And to witness the beauty of their art and their own creation was, for me, a religious experience. There was an overwhelming sense that I had entered the sacred. There was something inexplicably mystical in being present. There is, because of that experience, an awakening. Although theories abound, it is very likely that the paintings themselves have religious significance. Certainly there was something of awe that drew the painting and the painter together. So what is it that makes us religious? Now, Unitarian Universalists seem generally to dislike the term religion. But then that's also true of the word church or God. And given the popular synonyms and definitions of the word religion, like showing belief in reverence for God, or a belief in or the worship of a god or gods, or obligation or bond, as in the sense of life under monastic vows, given these kinds of definitions, it's understandable that we might have some difficulty with the term religion. And then if we're taught that religion is the basis for a plethora of wars in world history and continue to be a major element in many conflicts today, then our aversion to the word religion probably gains strength. But I've also suggested once before that there is a deeper understanding of religion. One of Reverend Forrest Church used often in his sermons with his own congregation in New York City. He said that, quote, "Religion is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and having to die." In the midst of the awe and wonder of the mystery of life itself is the great paradox that death is life's ending. Søren Kierkegaard said that we are both finite and infinite, with life moving inexorably towards its own end. But this understanding of religion, that it is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and having to die, is profoundly different from the traditional definitions and notions of religion. D.H. Lawrence, the British novelist, demonstrates beautifully this different approach. Now, I don't know a whole lot about D.H. Lawrence, except that his work, Lady Chatterley's Lover, is one of the sexiest novels I've ever read. And that his short novel, The Man Who Died, suggests that Jesus was not actually dead when he came down from the Roman cross. But apparently, as a young man, Lawrence had an exchange of letters with his mother's pastor when he left home for school. This is Lawrence's response to a sermon on the necessity of conversion for salvation that he received from the minister. D.H. Lawrence writes, "I believe that one is converted when first one hears the low, vast murmur of life, of human life, troubling one's hitherto unconscious self. I believe one is born first unto oneself, for the happy developing of oneself, while the world is a nursery, and the pretty things are to be snatched for, and the pleasant things tasted. Some people seem to exist thus right to the end, but most are born again on entering maturity. Then they are born to humanity, to a consciousness of all the laughing and the never-ceasing murmur of pain and sorrow that comes from the terrible multitude of our brothers and sisters. Then it appears to me one gradually formulates one's own religion to be what it may. A person has no religion who has not slowly and painfully gathered one together, adding to it, shaping it. And one's religion is never complete and final, it seems, but must always be undergoing modification." D.H. Lawrence was not a Unitarian or a Universalist, but this is Unitarian Universalism. When I am asked at a new to UU class if our denomination is a religion, I say yes. If religion is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and having to die, then Unitarian Universalism provides the faith community needed for individuals to slowly and painfully gather one's religion together, adding to it, shaping it, one that is never complete and final, but must always be undergoing modification. As such, Unitarian Universalism is a religion that is life-affirming rather than death-denying or death-defying. In Reverend Church's words, "Offering religious security blankets and heavenly insurance policies, many faiths base their considerable appeal on a denial of death. They reduce this life to preparation for the next, potentially finer life. I cannot accept their gambit. The price for defeating the presumed enemy is far too great. By refusing to accept the dispensation of death as a condition for the gift of birth, life's intrinsic wonder and promise are diminished." This sounds remarkably similar to one of the major themes in Brock's and Parker's book, Saving Paradise. If we see this life, our life in the present, as a gift, as paradise, then the essence of religion asks different questions of us than is traditionally the case. Rather than questions of belief or doctrine or creed, our religion asks us, what are we making of our lives? How deeply are we living our life? Are we truly committed to the health and well-being of our life in a holistic way? If we accept the gift of life for ourselves, do we also revere that gift in others? How, when our lives reach their close, can we be sure that they have been worth dying for? Religion, then, is a human response, a human enterprise, not because we need to believe something or in something, not because we are sinners who need atonement from a higher power, but because we were miraculously given life, with all its mysteries, including death, and with all its beauty. No wonder Unitarian Universalism is a small denomination. It's so much easier being told the answers to life. It's so much easier having outside authorities tell us what truth is, rather than struggling in the dark abyss of our own pain. It's so much easier to deny death its import rather than facing our own mortality. But religion, as a human response to life and death, is never, never superficial. For it asks that we awaken, to be present, to be alive fully. And I think this is what I was experiencing in the cave in France. I sensed that the people who painted the animals in the walls of the cave were so alive, so present, so awake. They were living religion in all its mystery and wonder and awe. And for a moment, I felt at one with them. So let me tell you a Robert Fulghum story as a way to make this a bit more concrete, something that brings this down to earth a little more. We often create for ourselves problems that don't have to be problems, or feel anxiety about things over which we have absolutely no control. When Fulghum was in his early 20s, he worked at a resort in Northern California. He and his employer did not get along. He writes, "One week the employees had been served the same thing for lunch every single day. Two wieners, a mound of sauerkraut, and stale rolls. To compound insult with injury, the cost of meals was deducted from our check. I was outraged. I went into the kitchen to get a bite to eat and saw notes to the chef to the effect that wieners and sauerkraut are on the employee menu for two more days. That tears it. I quit," says Fulghum. "For lack of any better audience, I unloaded on the night auditor, Sigmund Volman. I declared that I have had it up to here, that I am going to get a plate of wieners and sauerkraut and go up and wake the owner and throw it to Adam. This is actually one sentence. "I am sick and tired of this, and nobody is going to make me eat wieners and sauerkraut for a whole week and make me pay for it. And who does he think he is anyhow? And how can life be sustained on wieners and sauerkraut? And this is un-American, and I don't like wieners and sauerkraut enough to eat it one day, for God's sake. And the whole hotel stinks anyhow, and the horses are all nags, and the guests are all idiots, and I'm packing my bags and heading for Montana, where they never even heard of wieners and sauerkraut, crowd, and wouldn't feed that stuff to pigs." Something like that. I'm still mad about it.